Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. The impacts of Indian residential school is in Bombsida's summer spotlight. First, we'll hear from a residential school survivor, then from the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and how it's helping tell the stories of survivors and bring awareness to a tragic history in Canada. Plus, we'll hear about the efforts to have more schools recognized in a bid for compensation. And one young woman will discuss the impact residential schools has had in her family and her community and how things are beginning to change for the better. And in Manitoba, the Ministry of Education will be adding the subject of residential schools to its social studies curriculum for its high school students. Plus, of course, great tunes and all these stories coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Nunavik citizens in northern Quebec are now receiving compensation for the systemic slaughter of sled dogs by federal and provincial police in the 1950s and 60s that left Inuit communities devastated. The Toronto Star reports previous dog owners have started receiving payments. The Star also reports, while the Inuit insist the slaughter was part of a campaign to force them off the land and into federal programs and villages, federal and provincial authorities have said the cull was for public safety reasons. Last year, Quebec signed an agreement to pay out $3 million to support the Inuit in the protection of their culture. The agreement also provides plaques to commemorate the slaughter in each of the 14 communities. The federal government, however, has not compensated the Inuit for its role in the slaughter. Manitoba Chiefs and the federal NDP are calling for a national inquiry into the growing number of Aboriginal women across the country who have fallen victim to violent crime. The Canadian Press reports David Harper, head of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, has sent a letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper requesting him to commit to an inquiry by July 10th. The chief said the inquiry is needed to find out why Aboriginal women are disproportionately victimized and to root out the underlying social issues. Meanwhile, Nikki Ashton, the NDP's status of women critic, told media, Aboriginal women in Canada are at risk and the response as Canadians is woefully inadequate. And Rona Ambrose, Minister for the Status of Women, told CP that the government at all levels are already doing a lot. She pointed to a $10 million strategy to deal with Aboriginal women who have disappeared or were murdered. Inuit families in Baffin Island are mourning the loss of two men. The two men, 26-year-old Solomon Oyelkaluk and 21-year-old Ian Shuyuk, drowned last weekend in the Ottawa River. Oyelkaluk was in Ottawa with his mother for medical reasons, and before he left Arctic Bay, the member of the Canadian Rangers told his family it would be his last trip ever. Both men drowned after a late-night swim in the Ottawa River. A new report is looking at Aboriginal economic development across the country. The Leader Post reports the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board has released its report on the state of economic development. The report shows progress has been made, but the gap between Aboriginal people and the rest of Canada still exists. The report has four purposes. One, to represent comparative information on the economic standing of Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people. The second, to identify variations among Aboriginal heritage groups, First Nation, Métis, and Inuit, and where possible to identify the differences between on- and off-reserve First Nations. Three is to inform policy and program direction under the Framework for Aboriginal Economic Development. And according to the report, big strides need to be taken within the next decade if there's a chance of closing the gap between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. The Anishinaabe Nation has billed the province $127 million. The invoice is in lieu of benefits derived from the Ring of Fire in northwestern Ontario. The amount was based on a report produced by Dr. Fred Lazare of the Schulich School of Business. The report relied on data from the Chiefs of Ontario Revenue Sharing Report, the Public Accounts of Ontario, and various resources quantified for the NAN region. The $127 million is only part of the invoice to the province. The invoice has been been calculated over 100 years at current day values. The invoice has been calculated over 100 years at current day values and represents only a portion of the $32 billion owed. Deputy Grand Chief Les Ludit says NAN will submit an invoice every month and will also tack interest onto every invoice. Ludit also says NAN hasn't heard back from the province and says he doesn't expect to. The invoice was presented to the province of Ontario on June 27th. Provincial officials have been unavailable for comment. The federal government has earmarked $1 million for a three-year initiative to evaluate Active Circle. Active Circle is an initiative developed by Motivate Canada and supports mentors and youth leaders in the Aboriginal communities through sport, recreation, and physical activity. Several universities, including Ryerson, Nipissing, and Queen's, have partnered up with Motivate Canada and Aboriginal communities to come up with an evaluation tool. The Calgary Stampede is underway. The main entrance has been renovated to recognize Treaty 7 First Nations contributions to the 100-year-old event. A new sculpture was unveiled over the doorway, and it's shaped like half a teepee with five panels, and each of those depict a symbol to represent the Treaty 7 tribes. Kelly Goodeagle of the Siksika Nation said the symbols were originated from 1912 when Stampede founders first met the natives. Goodeagle also says without the founder of the Calgary Stampede, Guy Wiedick, fighting for Native peoples to be included, the celebrations of the new entrance wouldn't have happened. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Drunk as violence. be the longing lost in the rough. I pass you by on the borderline as the bitch that blows everything. On the borderline of everything. On the
That was Burnt Project 1 with Borderline. Indian residential schools were church and government-run schools for Aboriginal children to assimilate them into the rest of Canada. Attendance at the schools were mandatory, and about 1,100 students attended 69 schools across the country. And in 1931, at the peak of the residential school systems, there were about 80 schools running in the country, plus there were about 130 schools in every territory and province except Newfoundland. The last school closed in 1996. And so in all, more than 150,000 Aboriginal children were taken from their families and forced to attend those schools. Throughout the years, many students lived through horrific experiences. They lived through many kinds of abuses, and they were also forced to quit speaking their language. Attendance at the schools also created a divide between the students and their communities, often estranging them from family and community. 80-year-old George Beeswax attended Mount Elgin Residential School near London, Ontario. Here's his story.
I was 9 when I first went. I was in, started grade 4. For the first 4 months, I went there in September of 1941. And up till Christmas, I went to school all day. But after Christmas, it was cut down to a half a day. I went to school and I had to work the rest of the time. We worked at all parts of this. Of the farm. We had a large farm. We had horses and cows and hogs and chickens. We had to maintain all that, all those animals and where they lived. We worked really hard. Child labor, that's what it was. And if you didn't do your job, you got cuffed up or strapping from the supervisors. They were really mean. This went on until, I guess, till 1944. And we got a new principal in 1944. He was a little more lenient, but the rest of the stuff still went on. Work a half a day, go to school a half a day. And when we first started, the Indian agent came and these other characters painted a nice rosy picture of how we were going to go to the school, stay at the school, have the best of food and clothing, and be taught all kinds of trades. Have an excellent education. That was a bunch of bull. It was just the opposite. All we got was total beatings.
So what did you do after residential school?
I went to work on a farm, moved to Thetford, and I went to work for a farmer there. And I stayed with him for, around 5 years. And then I joined the army. I went to Germany for 2 years in the occupation force. Came back. Done an odd job in here. I dirt worked in Detroit for a while. Come back home and just kind of roamed around working here and there and all over. Then in 57, I got married in London. I went to work in a factory and I started to learn all kinds of building. How to build trailers, how to wire them, plumbing, and all that kind of stuff, which helped me later on in life because I went into my own business later on, which was doing building homes, doing roofing and all kinds of whatever's to be done in the house I could do. And then in 1973, I built a house here on the reserve, and that's where I'm living today.
So, George, how has residential school affected your life?
It's just awful. I just, what really, really gets me is my education. Grade 8, I went through grade 8 there, which was just a farce, really, because it was only equivalent to about grade 5 or 6. And the reason why they would push them through grade 8 is to make the supervisors and the teachers and everybody look good. So It would look awful to the government if they were failed everybody. So they just pushed everybody through, whether you were educated or not. It was just phony. And that's my biggest beef, really, is not being educated.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is, since that affected you, your biggest beef, you said, is the lack of real education that happened or didn't happen in residential school. So how are you able to move forward?
Well, I just live day to day, working. I was young and healthy. I could handle almost anything that came along. What I couldn't forget is that shithole we were in. And that every day I think about that. And that has affected me. I guess my hate for that place, because I can't shake it out of my mind. I don't think I ever will.
And so, and then back to the events in the community. So it must have been nice that, you know, at least you get that acknowledgement and you can talk about these things now and people know.
I was glad to do the interview there with the London Free Press. I just told them, but I was telling them, I told them what these schools were designed for. You know, they were designed to assimilate us. It's a genocide, I guess you'd call it. If one group tries to assimilate another group, that's they should all be shot. But anyway, that's stuck in my mind. It can't go away. And I'm glad that I let it all out when I done the interview.
That was George Beeswax, a survivor of residential school. Former students of most of those schools have received compensation from the government. The calls for victim compensation goes back to 1990 when Phil Fontaine, a residential school survivor himself and then leader of Manitoba Chiefs, called for the churches involved to acknowledge the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse suffered by the students at those schools. A Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples was convened by the federal government, and the commission heard the residential school experience, and then the commission released its report in 1996. The federal government announced its compensation package for $1.9 billion in 2007, but the common experience payments, as the compensation is known, didn't kick in for everyone. There's a number of schools that have been left out, and just last year, two more schools in Ontario were added to the list, and former students of those northern schools were encouraged to apply for compensation. Susan Vella is the lawyer for Windigo First Nations Council and the Anishinaabe Nation, and she tells us about the court case to have those schools recognized.
Last August of 2011, Anishinaabe Aski Nation and the Windigo First Nations Council won an important victory before the Ontario Superior Court of Justice. Chief Justice Winkler ruled in our favor, adding Sterling Lake and Crystal Lake residential schools to the list of Indian residential schools under the settlement agreement that was reached. It was important for a couple of reasons. The first is this was the first decision in Canada where First Nations was successful in having schools added to this settlement agreement, which would make the former students eligible to apply for compensation. And so this was a precedent-setting decision across the country. Canada then filed a notice of appeal because in Canada's view, these two high schools do not meet the criteria set out in the settlement agreement for the definition of an Indian residential school. As part of that process, we attended on behalf of NAN and Windigo before the Court of Appeal to oppose Canada's request to have the declaration issued by the Chief Justice stayed, which means that it would be of no force or effect until the appeal was decided. We were successful in resisting that stay motion, and as a result, the former students are able to now make applications for the independent assessment process and the common experience payment with respect to their attendances at Sterling Lake and Crystal Lake High Schools. We also have just received word from Canada that they have decided to abandon their appeal. So now the appeal is gone, meaning that the Chief Justice's declaration that these are indeed Indian residential schools stand, and we're encouraging all former students to file their applications.
And so what was the difference that the Canada was pointing out that didn't make these schools technically an Indian residential school in their eyes?
The Canada took the position that these were private schools operated by the Northern Youth Programs, which is a Mennonite reformed organization. They said that by the 1970s, when these schools were created, Indian Affairs had reversed its policy of having Indian residential schools and were now closing down residential schools as opposed to opening new schools. And so basically they said these are private schools, it's a different funding relationship. Northern Youth Programs was in charge of these schools. We weren't in charge of these schools, and therefore they're not Indian residential schools. Our response was that these schools clearly were Indian residential schools. They were created to fill what was a gap in Indian Affairs education policy back in the 70s, namely that students were having a rough time transitioning into the urban high schools and having to stay in boarding homes. And so at the time, concerned parents thought that it would be more beneficial to have students closer to home, so to speak, in the context of a residential high school run by this Mennonite organization. At the end of the day, Canada entirely funded these schools. They exercised control over these schools because they defined the enrollment list. They created the enrollment list. They and Northern Youth Programs could only admit students to their schools which were on these lists. These were residential schools in that the students had to travel to the schools and live there full time. They got their education there, and it was a completely segregated school in the sense that it was only for Aboriginal students. So, you know, what was kind of unique about these schools compared to the other schools listed on the schedule is that these were the first two high schools that are added. All the other schools were basically kindergarten to grade 8 or 9. And so that's somewhat unique, but in the criteria set out in the agreement, there was no distinction with respect to high schools versus elementary schools. So that was, you know, Canada's position and our response to it.
That was Susan Vella, lawyer for Wendigo First Nations Council and Anishinaabe Nation. Now here's Wayne LaVallee with Heartland. Reconciliation efforts have been ongoing over the past 5 years, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been charged with much of the responsibility. It's now more than just halfway into the Commission's mandate, and Chair Justice Murray Sinclair spoke with BOMCEDA back in March.
Well, we actually issued two reports. One was the historical report. Based upon the documents and the research that we've done to date, we were obligated under the settlement agreement, the mandate of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, was to provide a complete and accurate history of residential schools in Canada. In order to do that, we require access to a number of things, but first and foremost were the documents that are in the possession of Canada and the churches. They're required by the settlement agreement and by the order of the courts that approve the settlement agreement to give us access to all the documents that they've got and to allow us to make copies of them. That hasn't occurred to this point in time, and we're still engaged in the process of trying to get access to those documents. In addition to that, we are gathering statements from survivors. We've gathered a number of statements from survivors. We'll continue to do that. And the historical report will also reflect the stories of the survivors and their experiences while they're in the schools. And we think in order for the history to be complete, that those sources of information need to be referred to and need to be analyzed and provided. Because we haven't done that, the report that we've issued has been based primarily upon secondary sources, upon the statements that we've gathered to date, and upon the research documents that we've been able to create, and then the documents that we've been able to get. So it is not a complete history at this point in time. We think that by the time we finish the work of the commission, the history will be more complete. So we continue to write the information as we get it. That historical report, though, does contain a lot of information that probably people have not yet heard, because some of the stories of the survivors are quite clear, and we've been allowed to include some of them in there. And we've also been able to find some resources that were not referred to in other materials. But generally, it's a pretty fair and accurate history of the residential schools in Canada, but I think there's more to be written. Our second report that we did issue on Friday is what we call our interim report, and it really is a report about the activities of the Commission to date, what we've done, where we've done it, about the mandate of the Commission, and how we've been trying to complete the mandate and what remains to be done. So it's a much shorter report. It's only about 40 pages, but it contains a lot of information as well. And in that report, we've also contained a number of recommendations that we've aimed at the parties to the settlement agreement, as well as outside agencies, about things that we think need to be taken care of right away in order that the needs of survivors and the interests of Canadians are met immediately. And our intent there is to not wait until our reports are all being filed at the end of the commission in 2014, but to do what we can right now and to get started what we feel needs to be started right now. And we think those recommendations are very important. We also intend at the end of our mandate to do a complete piece of work on the issues as we've had raised with us by the survivors and by Canadians, and to make a fuller set of recommendations at the end.
And so you mentioned that you want to see some things taken care of right away. And so what are those items, and what are some of the other recommendations included in the report?
I don't want to try to go through all of the recommendations that we've listed, because there are over 20. But I'll just highlight a few of them, because I think that there are some worth mentioning. The first issue that we identified in the work that we've done today is the high level of ignorance that exists within the general population. And we don't mean that in a pejorative sense. We mean that in the sense that most Canadians, including a significant number of Aboriginal people, most Canadians and many Aboriginal people, simply do not understand the history and do not know the history of residential schools. young intergenerational survivors, that is the children, the grandchildren of Aboriginal people who went to residential schools, have spoken to us about the fact that they know there's a lot of problems in their communities. They know that there are problems within their families. They know that there are issues within their families that go back to residential schools, but they don't know what happened in those schools. They don't know what happened to their parents and their grandparents. They don't know what the things are that their families went through. So they haven't been able to connect all the dots. And so what we've said is a major recommendation in the interim report is that there really needs to be a significant public education campaign undertaken immediately by all of the parties to the settlement agreement, the churches, the survivor groups that are there, and the government, to educate Canada, to educate Canadian people about residential schools so that that lack of information can be overcome. And the importance of that for us is that in order for us as a commission to engage in discussions around reconciliation, around the question of reconciliation, for the future, we need to ensure that Canadians who have direct experience with the schools, the staff and the survivors and their families, and those who have no direct experience with the school, the rest of Canada, are able to talk from the same foundation of knowledge. And at this point in time, they can't, because those who have been in the school have a great deal of knowledge and awareness of what went on and why things are the way they are. But those who have no direct connection to schools, those who weren't there and their families have very things that are the way they are and how it connects back to the schools. And so the result is that when people talk to and about each other, the conversations are often filled with anger, stereotypes, and judgments that do not fit into the conversation. So we think that's very important to address, and we think it should be addressed immediately and not wait till the end of our report. We also have made some recommendations concerning the need for appropriate treatment centers to be established across the country to help the survivors. Survivors have been suffering in silence for a long time. Many of them have addiction issues coming out of their experience in residential schools and lives that they've led because of the pain that they've experienced in schools.
That was Justice Murray Sinclair, chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We've been discussing residential schools, and so far you've heard from a survivor, a fight to have more schools recognized so former students can have access to compensation, and also from the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now we'll talk to a community member of Chippewa of the Thames, Eva Jewell, and she'll tell us about the Mount Elgin Indian School commemoration event, and plus she'll tell us about how she's been affected and how things are changing for the better in her community.
Currently, there has been a lot of coverage on the Mount Elgin commemoration, Mount Elgin Indian Industrial School commemoration event. This is a pretty visionary event that happened on our reserve, simply because it's taken a long time for us to, as Anishinaabe people, to get to this point of healing where we can finally acknowledge and recognize our survivors, validate their experiences, and really hold them in high esteem for their resilience.
Did you have relatives that went to that school? And how has residential school impacted your life?
Yes, I'm directly descended from four residential school former students. They're not with us anymore. My grandmother, Eva Schilling, for whom I'm named. My great-grandmother, Gladys Madison Delary. My grandfather, Teddy Jewell, and my grandfather, Frank Delary, all went to residential schools. I think there's been an incredible impact that many of our young people today don't, I'm sure that a lot of them may not recognize the impact of the residential schools in their lives. And I think there was one particular man that was at Mount Elgin, and his name was Strap, and he was a principal, a teacher, he was a superintendent there, whatever he was an authority figure. He routinely beat the children. A lot of those children went on to hold that violence in their lives, and they perpetuated it because it was all they knew, and their children perpetuated it. So seeing as if Strap beat my grandfather, who went on to possibly, you know, lashing out, and there was violence in the home of my father's life, which went into the home of my home growing up. So I've experienced violence that stemmed straight from an oppressor that was in the residential school there. And so it's very present in our community today. It's the intergenerational, the historical trauma, the lateral violence, the inability to recognize what and where that oppression stems from.
So it seems that people are quite aware of it now. And do you see that the cycle changing in the community, or do you see that cycle actually breaking?
I think it's changing, certainly. It's made me aware, and because I was able to go and pursue an education, and I was really finding answers in my life. So I finding out why my community was the way it was, and I was able to realize that this colonization process is one that, you know, still continues today, but it influences my choices that I make now. So I'm not going to raise a hand at my daughter. And so I stop it. I'm realizing that it's my choices that stop the lateral violence or the intergenerational trauma.
So that's a personal point. And then when we're talking about that whole cycle is changing in the community, like, what are some of the ways, like, how do you see that cycle changing, and how are people doing that? Are they becoming more culturally aware and bringing back the teachings, and what is it taking?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a drive towards resurgence of our ways. There's people wanting to know and wanting to bring back those ways of knowing, of knowledge systems, of governance, of economic sustenance. People are reaching out for them because the way that the colonizer has oppressed us and has enforced their ways on us, it's not working for us. It's not even really working for them. So we see that we know we have that knowledge, and that knowledge is valid in our community. So our people are looking to that. They're realizing, they're recognizing in their healing processes that, yes, we have our own knowledge that will work for our people. So I think in terms of cycles of traumatic, of historical trauma, I think I hope that they're coming to an end. I think we're propelling towards that change. Of course, we still have a long way to go, but we have a valid knowledge system that can, I think, it's very possible to replace the system that the Indian Act forces on us with our own knowledge systems, our own governance systems.
That was Eva Jewell of Chippewa of the Thames. Now here's Ossini with Rise Up.
Rise up! We gotta work together now. Rise up! It's the only way. Rise up! Mother Earth, she's crying, and people are dying every day. How can we treat our world this way? What's it gonna take to make a change? Come on, come on, we gotta change. I can see with my heart, with my heart, with my heart. I can see with my heart, with my heart. Oh, I hold it in my hands, and I offer you a part, 'cause you taught me to see with my heart. To persevere and the will to make a difference that burns deep, not to turn your head and hide, that to
what's it gonna take to make us change?
Come on, come on, we gotta make a change.
Oh, I know I'm just a peon raising my hands to the sky.
Tired of asking age-old questions and hearing no reply.
But our children have no future.
Manitoba, the province, has decided to add the history of residential schools to its curriculum. This fall, students in Manitoba high schools will learn a lot more about the trauma experienced by First Nations people who were forced into the residential school system. The Education Ministry has developed more resource materials to be included in the social studies curriculums. Greg Pruden is the Aboriginal Perspectives Consultant for the Instruction Curriculum at Manitoba Education.
So the document was developed in response to Prime Minister Harper's 2008 apology to residential school survivors. It is intended to support grades 9 and 11 social studies teachers and students in Manitoba, so it's tied to learning outcomes of those two curricula. The project, the DVD, is kind of the heart of the project. However, it's not the sole component. There are a number of other components as well. There's a teacher's guide that helps, that will help teachers to implement the DVD. But in addition, there's a website with a comprehensive bibliography on residential school resources and support material. The webpage also includes links to a residential school survivor speakers bureau, and there is a gallery walk, a record of a students' project that they did 2 years ago. Involving the theme of residential schools. So the DVD fits within that list of components. The DVD itself, we began work on that in 2009, effectively. What we did was to contact a number of residential school survivors, make up a list, and we ended up with, I think, 8 of them that we interviewed. They were both first and second generation survivors, so children of survivors as well. We try to keep it as a Manitoba focus, so most of the survivors attended school in Manitoba, at least for part of their residential school career. So on the DVD, they're interviewed, and the DVD is broken down into 3 sections, the past, the present, and the future. And so the responses that we see from the survivors on the DVD are in relationship to those themes. So initially we have survivors talking about their experiences in their communities before their experiences at residential schools, and then we go through kind of what was like to begin this, to go to school in the first place, and how that affected them, We talk a little bit about their experiences in the schools. And then at the end, we talk to both the first and second generation survivors about the future. You know, what is it that you want to see from your perspective? And the DVD ends off with a comment from Grace Zoldy, who was a Métis survivor, and said, "I just want healing. That's all I have to say." And really, ultimately, when you come down to it, the whole thing is pointing towards that healing and reconciliation, as well as giving students and teachers a record of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the survivor components on the DVD, there are also archival footage showing old CBC footage of a residential school in northern Ontario, Moose Lake, I think. There are also the apologies by Prime Minister Harper from the House, and as well as responses by Aboriginal leaders. And we've also included an apology by then Manitoba Premier Gary Dewar that was made the following day in the Manitoba legislature, as well as statements by Aboriginal Minister Eric Robinson about his experiences in residential school, including the abuse that he suffered and the effects that this had on him.
And so I was wondering about something else. It's a very pretty heavy subject. And so do students get some sort of debriefing or an ability to talk about all that they've seen, heard, felt after watching the stuff?
Yes, we've tried to build in supports for the students. So in the teacher's guide, we note down that this is a very sensitive area, and students may be hearing about this stuff for the first time. They go home and talk to their families and find out that, in fact, there are survivors in their families. And in many families, it's not uncommon for survivors not to have talked about their experiences because of the trauma involved. And so we've made connections to the Truth and Reconciliation's crisis line. We give them that. We lay down a bunch of guidelines for teachers how to approach the topic. And as well, there are provisions for students to debrief through reflection journals, through discussions, and other means. But we're very much aware of the fact that this is a highly controversial subject, and that it could trigger reactions in survivors and perhaps disturb children as well, because a lot of what is talked about is quite graphic and it could be seen as shocking.
That was Greg Pruden, Aboriginal Perspective Consultant for the Ministry of Education in Manitoba. You've been listening to Bomb Siddall with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Siddall is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddall means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddall.